me switch.
Is this under that?
Hello. I'll be talking about cosmological perturbation theory in canonical variables, and I'm especially pleased to speak here today, given the fact that most of this work was done in this room, on this very blackboard. It's done jointly with Martin, Golam, and Shanke. On the earliest stages of this program, some other good people participated in the project, including Param and people from Potsdam. So this final stage took about a year, but I'll try to present it quicker. You're probably already convinced that perturbation theory is very useful when it comes to cosmological applications, but that's not what I'll be talking about today. I'll be focusing on the formalism, especially paying attention to gauge issues and anomaly issues, which become very important. I'll start with reminding you how it's done in the covariant formulation, then I'll, at the classical level, then I'll reformulate that on the canonical language. Jurek did something like this, but he worked in metric variables. I'll be doing the formalism in terms of triad and connection. And then I'll show how this analysis can be generalized to include quantum corrections. So I start with the covariant formulation, and the action I'll be working with is the standard Einstein-Hilbert action for the gravitational part, and matter is represented by a minimally coupled scalar field, phi, with self-interacting potential, V. And then we do perturbation theory around the flat Friedman-Robertson-Walker background. So I expand the metric in this form. A is the background scale factor, which depends on the conformal time eta. And then phi, psi, B, and E are the four metric perturbations corresponding to the scalar mode. That's what I'm focusing on in this talk. And the matter field is also split into background, phi bar, and its perturbation, delta phi. So normally in perturbation theory, one has some known solution for the background. It linearizes the equations of motion in perturbations and tries to solve them. The story is much longer when it comes to gravity because one needs to make sure that the perturbations are gauge invariant, that is, they have direct physical meaning and can be observable. So let's see how gauge invariant, gauge transformations and gauge invariant variables appear in this setting. So, first of all, for the background that I'm working with, again, flat FRW background, we have a preferable coordinate system. But as soon as we introduce perturbations, there is no preferable coordinate system. So we have a gauge freedom, and that, in general, leads to fictitious modes, which don't represent any physical perturbations, but they appear only because of bad or maybe good choice of coordinate frame. So we need to make sure that the perturbations we're working with are gauge invariant, that is, they're independent of the coordinate system used. So for that, we first need to see how gauge transformations go. And on the covariant language, they're just thought of as standard coordinate transformations with parameterized by the infinitesimal vector field psi mu. Mu goes from 0 to 3. And for scalar mode, it can be written just in terms of two scalar functions, psi naught, the time-like component, and the gradient of, another scale function, psi. Under this transformation, the four metric variables I introduced on the previous slide transform as follows. So, tilde variables are the variables in the new coordinate frame. And the matter field transforms like this. Here, A, again, is the scale factor. Dot indicates the conformal time derivative. And from these transformations, it's possible to construct three gauge invariant combinations. The first two, they are in the gravitational sector, phi and psi. They are referred to as Bardeen's potentials. He was the first who introduced these combinations. And then the matter variable can also be written in gauge invariant fashion. So you see it includes both the matter perturbation and the gravitational components, the metric components. So these three quantities will be gauge invariant under the coordinate chain. And then in terms of these gauge invariant combinations, one can write down equations of motion. For the background, we have the standard Friedmann, Raychaudhuri, and Klein-Gordon equations. This indicates a derivative with respect to phi. And for the perturbations, we have Einstein equations, which are the time-time equation, space-time equation, and the space-space equation, which actually has two independent equations corresponding to diagonal and off-diagonal components. On the right-hand side, we have the perturbations of the stress-energy tensor for the scalar field. And then we also have a Klein-Gordon equation for the scalar. Okay. In the canonical language, we first split the metric into the spatial metric Q, lattice function N, and shift vector NA. And if we perform Legendre transform on the action, we end up with three constraints and Poisson brackets. So Gauss constraint is solved explicitly, and we are left with only Hamiltonian constraint, and then we can also combine Gauss and vector constraint to give us a diffeomorphism constraint. So these are the two constraints we'll be working with. So we have each constraint for both gravity and matter. Here, I also introduced the triad E, densitized triad E, AI, which is related to the spatial metric as follows. F in the gravitational Hamiltonian is the curvature of the Ashtekar connection, and gamma is the Mirza parameter. The other variables are introduced on the next slide. So the matter variable is still the scalar field, which again split into the background and perturbation. The same is done with its conjugate momentum pi. These are not supposed to be x dependent. Okay. The barred variables only depend on the conformal time item. Then in the gravitational sector, we have triad. So this form is exactly to match the metric perturbation I introduced before. So this capital E and psi are exactly the same metric perturbations as before. Then it's convenient to work in terms of the... So the canonical pair would be triad and extrinsic curvature, K, which I can also expand in the diagonal background part, and the perturbation, which in general contains all diagonal components. The other ingredient we need to generate equations of motion is the Poisson bracket. Now, as we split the variables, we treat the averaged quantities defined here and perturbations, or the remainders, as independent variables. So we have Poisson brackets for barred variables for deltas, and the same for the metric or gravitational degrees of freedom. So now we have to...
So before I actually go to gauge issues, let me draw the connection between the canonical equations and the equations we saw before, the covariant equations. So in the canonical picture, we have two types of equations. We have constraint equations, which are only three here, background Hamiltonian constraint, perturbed Hamiltonian constraint, and perturbed diffeomorphism constraint equations. And they correspond to background Friedmann, perturbed Friedmann, and perturbed space-time Einstein equation, respectively. And then we also have dynamical equations, which are Hamilton's equations of motion. For each canonical variable, we have its conformal time variable computed as its Poisson bracket with the constraints. So on the background, we only have Hamiltonian constraints, so I'm not including diffeomorphisms here. But for perturbations, time derivative is given by linear combination of all constraints. I omitted lapse and shift parameterizing H and D, but they are given here. So this is a reminder. This is the triad perturbation. Lapse corresponds to the conformal time. P is basically square of the scale factor. So that corresponds to lapse equal A. And lapse perturbation and the shift perturbations are given here, and they correspond to the other two metric components. Okay, now let me tell you how gauge transformations are generated in this picture. We still take the same parameterization by Xi. The gauge transformations are generated by Poisson brackets with constraints, but for lapse and shift we take the following values. So that's given for any phase space function X. X just generic phase space function. And this parameterizes gauge transformation corresponding to parameters Xi naught and Xi. Then it turns out that the average quantities defined on the previous two slides ago, they gauge invariant, whereas the linear functions, their transformations are also linear in perturbations. If we consider the Lagrange multipliers, lapse and shift, in the covariant formulation, they're just the same as any other metric component. There is no difference between lapse and shift when it comes to a metric. But in the canonical language, there is no direct meaning to gauge transformation of lapse and shift. However, there exists an indirect procedure based on that lapse and shift have to transform in a way that makes the equations of motion consistent. Okay? And that also tells us how exactly they should transform. So, let me illustrate how it works. First, we can pick some equation of motion for some canonical variable x. Its dot is computed as Poisson bracket with the constraints. And this right-hand side, this Poisson bracket depends on, in general, on phase variables, lapse, and shift. Now, if we do gauge transformation of both sides of the equation, we can, in principle, compute how lapse and shift should transform. The non-trivial part of this recipe is how to compute the gauge transformation of the left-hand side. A priori, we don't know how to transform dots. And in fact, in general, gauge transformation of a dot is not equal to the dot of the gauge transformation. Okay? But we proved the lemma, which prescribes exactly how to compute gauge transformations of dots. That is, gauge of dot minus dot of gauge, this commutator, through Jacobi identity, can be shown to equal just a single gauge transformation, parameterized by only the time-like component of Xi. Okay, so with the help of this lemma, we can compute how left-hand sides transform, and hence derive how lapse and shift transform. Okay. Now we have all the ingredients,
to construct gauge invariant variables and gauge invariant equations of motion. So in this language, gauge invariance of an equation of motion means that when you gauge transform it, it just becomes zero. So if we consider dynamical Hamilton's equations, their gauge invariant by construction, okay, we found how Laplace and shift transform so as to make equations gauge invariant. The constraint equations will be gauge invariant if and only if constraints form first class algebra. That is, their Poisson brackets close. So let me illustrate it on a simple example. If we consider diffeomorphism constraint equation, which is del D del delta NA, and take a gauge transformation of this, then it's easy to see that the functional derivative commutes with the gauge transformation. And this quantity, the gauge transformation of diffeomorphism constraint, due to the closure of the constraint algebra, is simply Hamiltonian constraint. And obviously, if we take this functional derivative, we end up with another constraint, which is zero. So it works for any constraint system if they form first-class algebra. The constraint equations will be gauge invariant. Besides gauge invariance, there is also a consistency issue. On general grounds, we have three unknown functions, but five equations of motion. That is, Perturb-Friedman, Perturb space-time Einstein equation, two Ray-Chandra equations, and Perturb-Klein-Gordon equations. So the idea, and on top of that, we can use two of these three equations to eliminate two unknown functions. So, and we'll be left with diagonal part of the Perturb-Ray-Chandra equation. However, Klein-Gordon equation is not independent, and the Friedman equation constitutes a constraint. So, these equations, these five equations for three unknown functions will be consistent if the constraint is preserved under the evolution. So, constraint will restrict some initial data, and if constraint is preserved under evolution, so this system is consistent. This of course holds on the classical level, because we know, for example, from covariant formulation that these equations are consistent. Then on the canonical language, both things are ensured if constraints are first class. Now, if we go and quantize the theory, it's not a priori clear that this will still hold. And in fact, that's the very first issue one faces when quantizing a theory. It's referred to as anomaly issue. Okay, the constraint system is no longer first class. So, let me just quickly tell you how to generalize analysis to the case of quantum corrections. Martin and Artur explained, there is this effective approximation which allows to get quantum corrections without too much consideration of the quantum system. So the quantum variables I'll be focusing on would only be expectation values. It's shown that in many cases they provide already a very good approximation. And the recipe is the following. For classically well-behaved variables or expressions, expectation values are just replaced by the classical expressions, and classically divergent expressions, they are conveniently written as classical expressions times some correction functions. And and I'll be focusing on the inverse triad corrections here. And later I'll show how it can be done for other things. So again, these are the constraints. Diffeomorphism of constraints remains intact after effective approximation. Inverse triad corrections enter the Hamiltonians here, here, and here. And we introduce the three correction functions, alpha, nu, and sigma. And the very first assumption we made on them, which we're shown not to be able to satisfy, but inspired by the homogeneous isotropic situation from loop quantum cosmology, we wanted this functions only depend on triad, but not extrinsic curvature. Also depend on triad only algebraically. That is, they don't contain spatial derivatives of the triad. And we also want corrections depend on the full triad. So as to have them originating from some unperturbed expression. So here's once again the same assumptions. And then we need to check. We need to check if the constraints are first class, that is, if we don't have anomalies. If we consider Poisson brackets of H and D, we get one condition that alpha just has to have zero density weight. That looks obvious because otherwise the constraint is not defined. And if we consider H with H, we get another condition that alpha squared has to be equal to mu sigma and some very mild assumption about symmetry of functional derivatives, sorry, partial derivatives, which is satisfied for any correction function which has all internal indices contracted. Well, it turns out that the assumptions above cannot be satisfied. Okay, so these cannot be satisfied if we want to have this. So we have to relax one or more assumptions, and we did it. So you consider Poisson brackets of the constraints, and you want this to be a linear combination of the constraints. Okay? And that imposes this condition on alpha, which looks like almost no condition because alpha has to have zero density weight in the first place. Otherwise, you cannot introduce that into the Hamiltonian. And then you also consider Poisson bracket of H and H. And if you want that to be a linear combination of other constraints, then you have to satisfy this condition.
With the correction?
But here we also want this, that... you said corrections? Or perturbations?
Yeah, I was wondering what's the connection between...
Alpha, nu, and sigma are corrections.
Oh.
Okay? And these are the requirements on these corrections, so as to have first-class system, okay? Okay, so it doesn't work. We have to relax assumptions. And we do it in the following way. We don't... we're not as ambitious now. We want the constraint algebra to close at least perturbatively. And in the perturb constraints, we introduce some counter terms which are of the same form as already present there. And we introduce some additional coefficients, which are then restricted by the anomaly cancellation condition. And all these coefficients, there are several, not just one, these coefficients, they're proportional to H bar. So we neglect all terms, quadratic and counter terms. Still, diffeomorphism constraint is unchanged, but Hamiltonian constraint is. And when we do Poisson brackets and require anomaly freedom, there will be many restrictions on these counter terms. So it's a priori not clear and not at all trivial that there will be some solutions at all. In fact, there are solutions. There are non-trivial solutions. You can have quantum corrected constraints and still have them of first class. And based on that, you can construct gauge invariant variables and write down gauge invariant equations of motion, which I present here. So the background variables are still gauge invariant, and we still have the same three background equations, which now include quantum corrections. So alpha prime, nu prime, all these primes, they indicate derivative with respect to p bar.
So how are these alpha and
nu
related to perturbations of the canonical
alpha, all these correction functions, they depend on the triad. okay? And then you expand, try it, you have to expand.
And say, what enters here is background parts of them. They only depend on the background part of the triad, P bar. Okay? And for perturbations, we also have quantum corrections. Again, same equations, but quite a few new terms. All these F, F1, F3, G1 are some of the counter terms. And they're fixed by anomaly cancellation conditions. So they're just entirely expressed in terms of alpha nu. Okay. Yes. Okay, to summarize, we developed canonical perturbation theory based on triad and connection formulas. The lesson we learned is that, for example, gauge cannot be fixed prior to deriving equations of motion. We have to start without fixing gauge, derive equations of motion with quantum correction, then it's possible to fix gauge if needed. And also, we were not able to construct quantum corrections which depend on the full variables, only perturbatively. But still, we got some non-trivial deformation of effective constraints, which are normally free. Okay? This fact is quite non-trivial. And we obtained gauge-invariant equations of motion. So I haven't talked about applications at all, but let me mention that the effects manifest below Planck density, and they lead to non-conservation of power in the power spectrum on CMB. Thank you for your attention.
I have a couple of questions. Your point to when you say that you cannot you can find the anomaly-free conditions only perturbatively, you mean that your alpha function is something like 1 plus corrections? Or this statement is different?
Alpha is always 1 plus something proportional to some power of H bar.
So you cannot cancel these anomalies in your Planckian regime where you cannot write alpha as 1 plus some small Planckian correction.
Yeah, we can. That's can? Alpha is
alpha is 1 plus LP squared over P bar to some power and some constant.
Okay. So my question is whether it's possible over some no-go condition why you cannot get anomaly freedom in the case where alpha is cannot be written like that, but as in the near Planckian regime, where it depends on some positive power of P. In a super accelerating phase.
Right. That's below Planckian scale, but maybe we can get pretty close to LP.
Well, I think the other first question is that the regime, that is a certain
algorithm is going to enhance the possibility. Below A star.
But the one
that isn't. No. That's above. Yeah.
I have another question. Once you can fix the gauge, in earlier papers on perturbations in IQC, it was not clear whether the longitudinal gauge was a good choice or not. So can you comment about this one?
Okay, longitudinal gauge is a good choice, but you can only fix gauge after deriving equations of motion. If you fix gauge, no matter which gauge, longitudinal or any other, before deriving equations of motion, you are, first of all, you're losing control of diagonal equations, for example. And second, it's just impossible to get anomaly-free version of constraints if you gauge fix before doing Poisson break and so on.
Okay, so is the claim that the gauge choices which were good in standard GR would be good even in this case, but only after anomaly cancellation, etc., etc.
Well, in standard GR, if you're referring to Mukhanov's work, gauge is also fixed after deriving equations of motion. So they have Einstein equations, and they fix gauge after. They fix gauge in the Einstein tensor. So it's after deriving equations of motion. They don't fix it prior. Yes. Well, you can even fix it once you got like dynamical equations, like Hamilton's equations, before combining, say, pair of first order equations into one second order equation. You can fix gauge there. And actually, you can use that for shortcut of deriving this equation. Well, if you start with an action, you can always do Legendre transform and derive constraints. But it's not quite clear if you start with corrected constraint, if there is an action that corresponds. It's not clear. And right. So maybe I should a little bit rephrase that recipe, how to introduce counter terms. So this is purely for convenience reasoning. So we know that on the perturbative level, there are going to be some quantum corrections. Some of them we know. Some of them we expect, say, inverse triad corrections appear in certain terms. Some of them we don't know. So we just introduce some undefined coefficients to take into account those possible corrections. And then we just derive what those coefficients should be for anomaly freedom. That's not at all unique non-anomalous version of constraints, but we were mostly concerned with existence rather than with uniqueness.
Just to sort of contrast to the talk that Arthur was giving, where you are systematically starting with some constraint, then going to quantum theory, quantum space, and then doing some truncation, and then coming, and that was a derivation of the kind of quantum.
Right. This lacks that systematicity.
It's not like that.
No. You again referring to action? Or?
Yes, I mean, but one can't. I mean, it's not a canonical action. Once you have a modified constraint, you can have a then the statement is that you're making certain assumptions. But these are also under some assumptions. You allow certain yeah. corrections, allow certain other actions.
Right.
So you put that in that action, then what would be able to do it? But unless you make those assumptions.
So, from an effective field theory point of view, one thing you can do is sort of is try and categorize all the different possible corrections and then parameterize them, and then constraints on those parameters. So, do you have any sense of what the set of possible corrections is? Is there any control over that?
These corrections, they're completely fixed by those conditions. So we solve those equations.
All possible corrections.
Well, we okay. So if you expand the Hamiltonian, you'll have, like, I don't know, 12 terms or something. And then you just can, say, put by hand arbitrary coefficients next to each term. And then you do Poisson brackets and impose anomaly-free conditions. Many of those coefficients will be ruled out. That is, they should be just one. Okay? Some of them are not trivial. And in fact, we solved explicitly what they should be. Okay? So I just didn't include that in the talk, but yes.
Yes. But his question is, what else will there? These are the only 12 terms you'll get.
Well, you have just a few variables to play with. You have perturbation of the triad, perturbation of the extrinsic curves, perturbation of the matter fields, and you just consider all possible terms. Up to linear level. Okay. Right. We also want to have the correct homogeneous limit. That is, if we remove.
So I think what these questions are trying to get at is, is there anything being left out as linear order
or other expressions? Yeah. So higher order derivatives.
Oh, right. So, yeah. Okay, I see. Yes, we didn't assume any dependence. Yeah, so we don't include spatial derivatives, but of course we can, say, introduce terms which depend on the spatial curvature. They will contain spatial derivatives of the triad, and in fact, I have done some preliminary derivations which show that it's... But I don't want to interfere with Param. So, yeah, so, okay. So, again, here we assume that there is no dependence on the spatial derivatives of the triad, but, say, if you can assume dependence on the spatial curvature, which contains spatial derivatives of triad, and I've done some preliminary analysis which shows that, actually, it's possible to have anomaly-free version in that case. Okay, so as I said, it's not unique. It's probably unique in the simple minimalistic consideration, but you can always introduce curvature terms and extrinsic curvature terms. And, switch it off.